This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
Up first, here's President Simon and A.D. Hollis with MSU Admissions Director Jim Cotter.
We're pleased to welcome MSU Admissions Director Jim Cotter. Now, Jim, you've seen a lot of changes in the college admissions process over the years. So what's been the biggest change from your perspective?
Well, I think probably, President Simon, it's the sophistication of the student population. You know, parents are very, very involved in the process, but students through social media and I think really through their sense of maturity have put so much more thought into the process over the last 10 or 15, 20 years, where we see students who applied at one time to one or two institutions, we see them applying to 7 or 8 or 10. And it really does come down to the sense that when they go to the marketplace, they're very wise and very thoughtful in terms of making their decisions.
When you talk about parents being involved, you're looking at one that just has gone through it twice. What are some of the activities that parents generally get involved in when engaging with your office, when talking with folks on campus? You know, is it positive communication from the student's perspective? Is it negative communication? Do you feel good about those conversations?
Well, generally, I think it's very positive. But again, the means to communicate has changed so much over the last several years. Social media allows us to go right to the student. So maybe it's through Facebook, or maybe it's tweeting them, or perhaps it's text messaging them, or whatever the case might be. And yet we've had to be very cautious about continuing with print recruitment materials, because we still want the parents to feel
somewhat involved. Go back to the social media. I've been spending a lot of time speaking publicly about social media. Is that becoming too much of part of the process of talking with kids? Is the eye-to-eye, you know, face-to-face communication starting to wane away, where too much of it is being done with a student looking at a screen?
I think you have to be careful to use it as a piece of the puzzle. I mean, still the most important portion, the most important piece of the college decision process has to be the campus visit. You've got to get the people on campus. They've got to try it on. They've got to see it. You have to have that face-to-face communication. But maybe you only have one or two chances to do that, and so you need to stay in touch with the student throughout that cycle. Mm-hmm. And I think the social media option gives us just that opportunity.
Yeah.
So you both have children that are of the looking age of college.
We
do. Yes, indeed.
So talk with me, Jim and Mark, about what it's like to recruit a student and what it's like to be the parent of a student being recruited.
Well, I tell you, and Mark and I can tell you this, we view this university from so many perspectives, as undergraduates, as graduate students, as university administrators. I don't think there's been a more important experience for me personally than to view this institution as a parent of a daughter who came to Michigan State and a son. What you learn very quickly is this is not my institution. This isn't Mark's institution. This is our kids' institution, and the experience that they have is very different than the one we had. And so I think it's important that we understand, you know, it's logical for us to think that they're just going to come to Michigan State because it's part of the legacy and part of the family and part of the heritage. But what I've discovered through both our daughter, Margo, and our son, Jimmy, is the fact that they've made it their experience, which was very different than my own. I don't know, Mark, was that kind of your sense?
Yeah, my daughter had an opportunity to visit several campuses, and it was by her choice. And what I found in the process, and I don't know if it's because of the role that I'm in and engaging with parents in both, you know, positive and negative conversations, was to be supportive and not directive in the process. And through that process, I sometimes got frustrated that I didn't feel like she was doing enough initiative on her own to really get to where I thought she should be. And, you know, I found myself starting to interject a little bit on pushing, and then I had to pull back, go, no, this is your process. If you want something successful, you're going to have to put the effort forward. And, you know, if you're there for them on the admission process from a directive, not a supportive standpoint, I think that connection is going to continue. And I don't think that's good for students. I think part of the process is for parents to like let it go a little bit and let students make some mistakes, make some errors, and find a way to do it. And I, you know, I think she's done a pretty good job of catching up, but I was a little frustrated at part of the process.
Well, and it's like all of us. There's a degree of familiarity with Michigan State on the part of our kids, and I kept finding myself thinking, don't make that assumption. I know you've seen this place as a visitor,
exactly.
but you've never
mm-hmm.
seen it as a student. And start thinking about undergraduate research. Think about social outreach. Think about all the things that maybe you haven't thought of as you were sitting in Breslin Arena watching one of Tom Izzo's teams beat Indiana, beat Ohio State, Wisconsin, whatever it is. This is such a big institution, and there are so many wonderful opportunities for students to get involved that, you know, I kept finding myself saying, well, maybe you should think about this part of it. And then just
right.
like you, I said, oh, we've got to pull back a little bit here. You know, this has got to be their choice.
Well, I want to cycle back because Mark has still one more to go in this
Good
process.
Good luck with that one.
in this process. Preparing for college is not something you start in your senior year. We've seen, you know, letters that I get from parents who are a bit concerned about their son or daughter. You see this sort of kid getting focused about, you know, the end of their junior year, second semester, junior year, and saying, well, now I think I can get ready for college. So let's talk to the parents of eighth graders or whatever. And what advice do you have looking at this admissions process, not only from the perspective of Michigan State, but you're a respected leader among admissions officers in Michigan and also across the country. So what's the advice for the eighth grader? You can help Mark out here a bit.
Well, I tell you, it goes back to your first question. And that was very much along the lines of what are the changes? And it was okay at one time, if you look 15 years ago, to say, okay, now I'm going to pump it up and get in the classroom and get serious as a junior and a senior and I'll be okay. And now I think it's really critical that one's success to some degree in college has to be measured on their preparedness in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And their preparedness for high school really does go back to the middle school, junior high experience. And so it's critical that students have exposure to things like foreign language as a middle school student and mathematics. You know, at a place like Michigan State where we have 200 areas of study, and we bring in a freshman class of 7,800 students. There are some of those individuals that can come here and realistically, seriously look at every one of those 200 majors and probably do it. Unfortunately, there are students who come here who probably limit themselves in terms of their options because of their preparation or lack thereof. So I think that it's important for our 7th and 8th graders to begin to, whether they're a first-generation student or whether they're a multi-generation student, to begin thinking about what do I need to do to prepare. What kinds of rigor do I need to bring to my curriculum, but also the sense of what do I need to do in terms of personal maturity to be a successful college student? What kinds of activities do I need to be part of to support my academic preparation? You know, President Simon, you so often talk about the holistic review and looking for that diamond out there that may not shine quite as bright as the other because of whatever experiences they might have had or didn't have. And mm-hmm. and so I think that it's a total preparation. But I think a 7th or 8th grader beginning to acknowledge that college is part of their future, what it is that they're passionate about, and what it is they're best at, and then nurture those pieces.
I think when you look at a sports analogy, it's, you know, we always make a phrase, you're getting better, you're getting worse, you're never staying the same. You can focus on your own child, but it is a competitive world, mm-hmm. and there are others in that world that are competing for spots at certain universities like Michigan State. Where has our demographic or our challenge changed over, you know, the last decade or so? I look back to when I was a student, and I try to think of myself. I think I'd still get in, but, you know.
Maybe.
Yeah,
I think you would.
It's much more, it appears to be much more competitive than the environment that I encountered in the late 70s, early 80s during my process to get in. And do we look different than back then? Is it changed? Is the demographics of the state of Michigan created new challenges?
Well, I think we look different in a lot of ways. I think this continues to be really a model of diversity across the Big Ten. I think when you look at academic models and look at academic averages, we've become a more competitive institution in terms of grade point averages. But then the question is, where does grade inflation play into that? If you look at our test profiles, they've improved, which I think are standardized and maybe a bit more creditable when you start looking at academic models. Mm-hmm. But we've become more diverse geographically. We live in a state that a few years ago produced 123,000, 125,000 graduates. And by the time we get to 2025, 2026 in the state of Michigan, quite frankly, we're going to be around 83,000 graduates. So demographically, the number of available students in the state is decreasing. And I think that's one of the reasons why Michigan State, one of the reasons, is has expanded its recruitment beyond the state's state of Michigan, and really beyond the borders of this country. We've become very assertive in becoming what President Simon refers to as a world-grant institution. Mm-hmm. And it would be very difficult to be a world-grant institution if you were strictly Michigan residents in terms of the freshman class. So I think we're more geographically diverse. I think we continue to do diversity very, very well, but I think there's always work to be done academically. I think if we were to look to the president and say, how do you feel about the class? I think she would say, you know, I really like the top quarter of the class, but how about tweaking the bottom quarter? How about taking that 92% retention rate at the freshman level to sophomore and making it 94, 95? How about taking that 56% four-year graduation rate and bringing it up to 60 or 65? Or how about taking that six-year graduation rate of 86% and bringing it up to 96%? So I think there's always this sense of looking to improve the quality of the cohort, but also remaining true to our land-grant philosophies of opportunity to students. I mean, you look at our freshman class, we're going to be 25, 26% first generation. And that provides some special challenges for this institution as we provide an opportunity for success for those folks.
I think that people focus on a particular aspect of the class, and forget that we have a very large class. And so when they hear numbers about a particular segment of the class, it's not put in the context of still admitting what we're going to have 7,600, 7,800 people coming in with this declining demographic in Michigan. I would also say that we're probably focusing much more now on what we can do once they arrive to move those numbers than simply moving them by changing the entering demographics. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think the intersection with holistic admission is going to be a little bit more interesting in the coming years. That the question is, what of the student experience can we use to predict how well students will engage here when they arrive, even though their test scores may be very much the same or one may be a bit lower than the other? But it's that engagement, it's that passion, it's the sense that I'm prepared to overcome obstacles, because there are going to be obstacles with a large number of first-generation students that we have, with others who are much more sophisticated in higher education. I'll take your kids as an example. Having grown up around a university, sort of understanding what it was like, mm-hmm. not being concerned about how to get from here to there, better understanding.
Our kids already think they've been there. That's the problem.
you have that problem. But you also have – and so they're going to coast a bit because they already think they know everything. Yeah. And then on the other side, you've got the kids who are really genuinely having the equivalent of the jump in the deep end of the pool.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we need – and so our commitment as a part of Boulder by Design is really to see how the entire university, not just changing the admissions criteria – can affect those numbers much more dramatically, but still keep the commitment to a very middle class, very large first generation set of individuals for whom Michigan State is that real pathway to opportunity. So it's an interesting challenge.
You know, I think about a conversation I had with my son earlier this week, going to be a junior here at Michigan State, grew up in a suburban town here in the middle of the state of Michigan, and yet one of the relationships he's developed is with a graduate international student over the course of the last couple of months who lives in the same apartment complex, and he's talked about some of the things they've discussed late into the evening about their different family histories and how they've grown up. And I think in many ways, and no offense to faculty, but perhaps some of the most important lessons he's learned in the last 3 or 4 or 5 months have really resulted from his exposure to another culture. And I think that really the university is I think we're responsible to create those kinds of dialogues.
This is MSU Today with Russ White on AM 870 WKAR.
And you're listening to MSU Admissions Director Jim Cotter talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis.
And I would say, you know, if you think about athletics as a team effort, in your experience in baseball, your position didn't always get all of the balls hit at them. But everybody has
to. You got into the bench.
And many ended up in the river, if I remember correctly.
But it's not really thinking about who did what at what time. It's really the faculty who prepared Jimmy. Through courses that he probably wasn't very interested in as a freshman or sophomore, as we, you know, talked about world issues, diversity, internationalization, pushing study abroad, all those things that are part of that first couple of years that kick into gear to permit that those conversations to occur.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think you're absolutely right, and I bet Mark would agree as well. Some of the conversations I've had with Jimmy about the fact that the faculty members that he's engaged with, who he's met with after class, who have shown a concern for him. And I think so often when we talk about a large institution, there's this sense that every class is 400 or 500 and there's never any exchange between students and faculty. And yet, when I talk to my son, I realize there are some faculty that he's gotten to know very, very well who he's taken advantage of those office hours, and he's learned from them. And I think to watch someone grow and mature like that, it's a lot of fun.
One of the conversations I like to have is with a recruit that we don't get, that doesn't make the choice to come to Michigan State. And part of it is to go through a process of how can we improve, how can we get better. You and your staff have countless conversations and countless opportunities to talk to students. Is what you're hearing from them, President Simon talked about study abroad. I think you can talk about our neighborhoods that we're building across campus. Are you hearing different things than maybe what we've heard 10, 20 years ago? Are the conversations sort of the same? Do you feel like you have an opportunity to tweak improvement when you hear multiple responses on if Michigan State had this, it may be a better choice, or these are great, this is phenomenal? Do you hear those conversations? Does it?
Yeah, we do, Mark, and sometimes it's difficult because we have to hang back and realize, as you mentioned earlier, that it really does come down to a sense of fit for a student. And if an individual decides not to come to Michigan State University, I don't think it's always a negative. I mean, it really is. Everyone needs to find the best fit for themselves. There are a lot of tremendous institutions in this country. Mm-hmm. But I do think that one of the challenges we have is helping students understand the vastness of opportunities here. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that so many of our students are involved in undergraduate research. What does that mean? I mean, I think students come from a traditional classroom where they learn from a book and they learn from a lecture. And yet at Michigan State, what we're asking them to do is to take those lessons, as the president was referring to a moment ago, and engage and to really process and to begin to put into play the lessons they've learned. And so when a student decides, well, I'm going to go to school X or Y, I almost am inclined to say, but did you consider this? And did you consider study abroad and the wide array of languages to take? And did you talk to your parents about the ability to become not just a part of Michigan State University, but a part of the community? Mm-hmm. And then I have to say, well, wait a minute, Jim, time to back off. They've made a decision about where they ought to be and what the best fit is for them, and that's okay. Because there are a lot of great institutions out there. In your mind, in my mind, in President Simon's mind, it was the best for us. But mm-hmm. there also has to be that sense of what's best for another student. And, of course, if we don't get them for undergraduate, maybe we can get them for graduate school.
We have a friend whose son has, at the last minute, decided to go to a very small private school rather than Michigan State. And the father's devastated, because he can't imagine his son in an environment that is that small. Mm-hmm. But it was a comfort level for the son, and so on the other side, on the sort of the advantages of big, I think. We'll talk about the neighborhoods and sort of this, how you can have the best of both worlds, which is a part of the Michigan State, I think, advantage right now, which is producing all these applications and and that we're pleased that you're generating, but people are looking at that sort of balance of big and small.
Well, you know, and it's interesting, you're talking about the fact that students sometimes begin at another institution. You know, we probably are as transfer friendly as any institution in the state, maybe as any institution in the Big Ten. So occasionally a student will decide to seek a comfort zone and at the end of that freshman year think, ooh, maybe I want to stretch myself a little bit. But in terms of the neighborhoods, I always have to smile when I go to New York or I go to L.A. or I go to Chicago and someone says, but Michigan State's so big. And I'm thinking to myself, now, wait a minute, you're from one of the largest metropolitan areas in the world and we're big. But, you know, it is important to stress to people that this is much like a large city. You create a community, and that community has academic support, it has health support, it has counseling support, and it really does become the framework from which you build. It gives you a place to start. And then you build as far as you want to build in terms of creating relationships and engaging in challenge. And I think the neighborhoods, quite frankly, are something that we've done for a long time without maybe knowing. And now we're adding a very formal kind of process to it. And I think you've led us in that direction, Dr. Simon, to the sense of realizing we've always had kind of these neighborhoods, but now they have more of a formal kind of feel to them, more of a planned feel to them. And I think that message resonates very, very well with students who say, but you're a large public institution. And there are ways to break it down. And when you look at our residential colleges, when you look at Lyman Briggs and James Madison and the Residential College for Arts and Humanities, you can put those programs, those colleges up against many, many small private institutions, and the similarities between the college and the private institution, very similar. And yet, when you broaden beyond that residential college, the plethora of experiences, sure, the largest study abroad in the country, undergraduate research, 500 clubs and organizations, intramural sports, big-time athletics, And being able to go, and you guys know this, you get on a plane and you have a Michigan State shirt on or a Michigan State medallion on, and there's immediate recognition.
I think the neighborhoods, I think, are a bit of what I would call the family atmosphere of Michigan State. But what it does is it permits a student from any major to have some of the benefits that are often ascribed to the residential colleges, the residential programs, and add a bit of health, be a little bit more purposeful in the co-curricular activities that we're providing in those areas, so that you can have the language tables without being a language major. And you can have the support in mathematics or writing or other critical things without being in a special program. If you choose, if you want to sort of blow past that and explore the university in a broader way because you're the adventuresome sort, it works out, I think, for you as well. So I think it's that purposefulness. And now I think we're going to move to more of a freshman-sophomore transition into academic experiences that we think will also give students a better sense about what they're studying, what it means to be a major in X, Y, or Z, what the work is like. And then in addition, I think we've added, and in the neighborhoods, a lot of creative activities. The Media Sandbox is just a place where people go and they create games and videos and films and those kinds of things. Same thing if you want to be an engineer, you can go off and go to the residence hall and look at the shop and maybe for the first time build something with your hands out of wood or metal that you didn't do because you played so much with your 3D video images. And it's a good way to learn that what's on the computer screen doesn't necessarily match what happens in real life. And those kinds of creative experiences, the entrepreneurship experiences that will be built in McDonald are, I think, the next generation of this, recognizing that students can learn facts through the computer. They can't necessarily get information by taking those facts, and they also can't maybe get the life lessons that they need to apply those in ways that make them valuable to the workforce. So it's a very complicated process that you have to talk about in sound bites.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, I've heard you say this so many times, this is a competitive environment, but a collaborative set of people. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a place where we're competitive. I mean, this is a place that is really competitive, but it's a collaborative kind of competitiveness. And I think that that's one of the things that really sets Michigan State apart. And it's one of the reasons that we're a world changer. I mean, we just are. I tell students all the time, you come here, changes your life. You don't come here, we're not done with you. Right. We're going to be impacting your life forever, whether it's cancer research, whether it's biofuel research, whether it's food research. This is a, you know, as our Spartans will tells us all the time, we're game changers.
So let me close with sort of the piece of advice for those eighth grade parents about how to think about a high school program that would let their students, their son or daughter, have a wide range of choices, not necessarily narrow their choices by what they choose to do in high school. So
I think we encourage young people to stretch themselves, to challenge themselves, to be strong, outstanding, or strong academic performers, but also encourage them to reach out to others around them. I mean, I think that's one of the things that Michigan State does all the time. Be careful about specializing too early. You know, it's good to be a solid math performer, but don't cut back on reading in the summer. Mm-hmm. It's great to be a sound writer, but don't be afraid of looking at an advanced biology class. And, of course, language is so important. You know, we require 2 years. Hey, if you're going to take 2 years, why not take a third year of a language? And if you're going to take 3 years, why not take a fourth year and then jump into it when you're in college? Because we are a global environment. And so I think as parents, encourage their sons and daughters to be successful. Maybe the best thing we can do is to encourage them to be just as good as they possibly can be, to always be a little leery of being too comfortable, to push ourselves to take the next step, whether that's academically, whether that's socially, whatever it might be, but to encourage young people to take smart risks, risks that will push them to become better people. And when it comes time for the college selection process, that'll work itself out.
People hear the phrase holistic admission, and they have lots of interpretations of that. So I'm the kid who may have a little bit lower grade point average, but I'm the one who took those biology courses when I really sort of liked English. Or I'm the kid who sort of took an extra AP course and didn't do quite as well as I might have. Against the kid who sort of took the safe route through high school. How does Michigan State look at those two kids?
You know, I'll tell you what, interesting to bring that up. Wednesday evening I had a conversation with a young person from Southeast Michigan. And, you know, we've had incredible numbers of applications, and we've had great success, and I think the university is in a very good position. But because of that, we've had to take a few of our folks who wanted fall and defer them to spring. I had a conversation with a student on Wednesday night who said, will you do me a favor? Will you go out and look at this video of our graduation? The student said, I was asked to speak at graduation. So I went out and watched, and this was a student who we had not admitted for fall. We had asked to come and join us in January. And I watched it, and I went back and watched it one more time, and I called her back, and I said, you know what? You're going to be the last student admitted to the fall semester at Michigan State University. Your message resonated in a way that we need you here in the fall. The college admissions process isn't just about what are we going to do for a student. It's very much important that we look at individuals and say, how will they make us better? And this student was clearly admissible, but perhaps not quite as strong academically as the few students who made it in before her.
Quantitatively.
Exactly. Quantitatively. And yet, when you listen to her message and the passion in which this individual spoke, and in the mesmerizing kind of way in which she had the audience in her hand as she was speaking about her hopefulness for the future, I thought to myself, we need this kid.
We are in a position where more students who could succeed at Michigan State are applying than we can legitimately take and provide a high-quality experience for them. And we owe that to anybody who's here is to have that world-changing experience. So this holistic admission is about looking at some of the intangibles. Part of it is the strength of academic program and the adventuresomeness of academic program. But it's also these other things as you get into that piece where you may not be the 4-point student with the perfect ACT.
Absolutely. There are cases where students have overcome some challenges. And because of that, they will persist. They will succeed. And so the holistic review is not just It's not just lip service. It really occurs. The personal statement that we read, I would tell you that some of the personal statements are just so-so, and some of them are so compelling that they drive the decision.
Well, Jim, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, folks.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
That was MSU Admissions Director Jim Cotter talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear their conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. Up next, here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with MSU Museum Director Gary Morgan.
Well, it's our pleasure to welcome the MSU Museum Director Gary Morgan. We have some very important work coming up in support of the Renaissance of Detroit.
Well, I'm very pleased to be here. It's a great opportunity to chat about Detroit Resurgent, which, as you say, is a project we're very proud of, one that we think mixes and fits very well with the agenda for MSU in terms of its partnerships with Detroit.
What's your, I'm assuming that you've spent some time in Detroit already surveying the landscape down there. What's your initial impression of our city?
Well, personally, I love Detroit. I just think it's got so much energy to it. It's got a fantastic history, but it's also got a vitality which is very palpable. It's an interesting question you ask. I think the listeners will probably pick up that I don't have a local accent, and my friends and family back home in Australia are horrified when I say that I and my wife go into Detroit not only on business but for recreation, because the image of Detroit, which is broadcast very widely and very effectively by various elements of the media, is of an Armageddon-like place. It's a place of razor wire and crime and vacant blocks and decay, and people really find it hard to believe that we would be going to the city. And I have to assure them that this is a place that's very much alive, which is still palpating with life, and that is very much at the heart of the Detroit Resurgent project that we've established.
Earlier in the month, I had an opportunity to be with national AP writers down in Detroit, and it was interesting. I asked the same question. It was interesting to get their perspective of the city, and as you probably can guess, our state kind of lives off the muscle and the innovation that can come out of Detroit and bleed in, and it was interesting to get their perspective because, like so many people, once you get in there and you see what's occurring today, it's taking the muscle of our history, and it's interjecting a lot of innovation. Dan Gilbert, who is an alum of Michigan State, is one of the leaders in that process, and it's really going to open up for you some exciting opportunities as we take this project from campus, and I believe we're going to take it down into the city as well.
We certainly are.
Why don't you make sure our listeners know what the project is and then how it's going to impact both Michigan State and the city.
Detroit Resurgent is two primary elements. The first is an exhibit, and the second is a companion book. The exhibit will be launching in September of this year here at MSU. In April of next year, we will take the exhibit to Detroit, and then we'll be able to launch the companion book. And the third element for Detroit Resurgent, and we believe this is as important as both the exhibit and the book, will be the raft of activities and talks, discussions, community brown bags, etc., which we hope will be able to happen around the exhibit and the book while it's based in Detroit. I think in many ways its life in Detroit will be its most important phase. And we want to have it based at the MSU Woodward Center, Detroit Center, which we hope will be a real attractor to get people from the Detroit community in and intersecting with a wide variety of MSU faculty and others who are involved in many different ways in this renaissance of Detroit as a great city it will be again.
So I grew up north of Detroit. My childhood was late 60s, early 70s, interesting times in Detroit. If I was to take my 14-year-old son in to see this exhibit, what would I be showing him? What would he feel? What would I be able to express to him about that city?
This is an exhibit, and it's a story about people. And as such, it's a counterpoint to the very widespread media coverage of the decay of infrastructure. There have been some great books and even some exhibits which have focused on the buildings as they've essentially turned to rubble. And they've done that in beautifully evocative ways, gorgeous, gorgeous photographs, but all about things, all about infrastructural decay. Detroit Resurgent is about people, and it's about the energy of people. And what I would hope that he would take away would be the feel for what is happening there, grassroots activity from the wide diversity of people who, in the words of Mark Benelli from his book Detroit City is the Place to Be, do see Detroit City to be the place to be. And the only thing that these people have in common, given the wide diversity of the backgrounds, given the wide variety of the endeavours in which they are involved, is that they believe that Detroit can be great again. They believe this is the place that they want to live in, it is the place that they want to rebuild, and it's that shared energy which I hope will be the strong underpinning foundation of this exhibit and the book that will follow.
Could you describe a couple of vignettes or photographs or stories that would be about these people, and you may have your favorites, you might have some that are contrasting in terms of their experiences, but give them sort of a glimpse of the people.
We have 62 stories in the exhibit and the book. 62 stories of the 700,000 of stories that make up Detroit. So we don't pretend that they represent Detroit. What we've tried to do is have stories that reflect the diversity. And they vary from people who you might expect to be in a coverage of Detroit, like Grace Lee Boggs, one of the longest-term activists there, lived in Detroit all her life and really made a case for its revival. People like Bob King, who is president of the United Auto Workers, etc., they're prominent individuals, but also those who many will not know about, perhaps. People like Larry Gabriel, who's made Detroit his home all his life, and is a great writer, and he in fact is contributing an essay to the book as well. Shahida Narula, who is just a wonderful jazz and blues singer, who could have pursued her career elsewhere, but has stayed in Detroit because it has this essence of soul. And one of the common stories that comes from the people is that they're motivated in part to be in Detroit, not only for the personal opportunity that provides them, but because it is so exciting to be part of this history and this heritage. A number of the subjects refer to this tradition of Detroit being a city of fighters, a city of entrepreneurs and create, and they love the history of the Motown, etc., and all of that part. And while Detroit has moved on from that, they want to still be part of this continual evolution and renaissance of the city. And I think it's that shared energy which excites me about the project. There's a recent publication from the Brookings Institution, the Metropolitan Revolution, and what it draws upon are case studies across America, including Detroit. And what it demonstrates is the renaissance of cities won't be coming from the top down. It won't be coming from the federal government, and in many cases it won't be coming from state governments. It's going to be coming from really strong grassroots partnerships. The people who call the city home, working with civic leaders, working with local political leaders, and importantly working with universities. Universities are absolutely key partners in these renaissance. So we think that as a statement, as a symbol, this product, Detroit Resurgent, is very much evocative of those long-term partnerships. Not the external consultants coming in with the quick-fix solutions, but people who are willing to work together for the long haul without any surety of what the final outcome is going to be.
I think part of that has to roll along, and I love the way that you phrase that, of the Renaissance coming from the ground up. Is the people of the state of Michigan understanding Detroit as a beacon or as a symbol for our entire state. And in so many cases, we find ourselves going into the city and then returning either back to the suburbs or back to outstate. And you spend a little time there, and I've had an opportunity to be down there quite a bit over recent times and throughout my childhood. You really have to engage yourself, and you have to be part of that process of turning around and sending the message, delivering the message, talking about the great things that are being done there. And when you talk about that renaissance, I think that's part of our role as well, even here in East Lansing. And I know President Simon has taken a huge leap in that process of really engaging our faculty, our staff, our athletic department, in that role of connecting the city with the state of Michigan.
When you came to Michigan State, what surprised you about these broad connections to community?
I think the sheer magnitude and extent of them was surprising. This was my first employment within a university, and certainly the sheer scale of MSU was daunting to begin with. After 4 years, it is still rather daunting. Every day I'm surprised to hear of another connection, another link. And I think particularly the land grant, world grant commitment of MSU reinforces both the necessity of those links and the absolute essential commitment that a university makes to the communities that it serves. East Lansing is a relatively small community, but the span of MSU and the links with Detroit are as important as even the local links, and arguably more so for very much the mm-hmm. what we've just discussed, and the span of MSU, which extends and takes those same principles and commits them to Africa, where I spent 2 years prior to coming here, and realizing just how significant MSU's programs are in the little country of Malawi, where I was based for 2 years. That was a surprise to me. You are just reminded that there is no part of the globe where a large community-focused university cannot have a viable partnership and a very significant contribution to make to the viability of those communities.
As you were preparing this Detroit Resurgence project, do you have any favorite MSU projects in Detroit? Did you find some that you really sort of tugged at your heartstrings or rose to the top of the list?
Well, one that I find intriguing, and again it comes back a little from my time in Africa, is the recognition of how successful some of the urban agricultural projects have been in Detroit. And the reason I say that's interesting to me, because urban agriculture is also a program which is being advocated in quite a number of the largest cities in Africa, Nairobi and elsewhere. And what we're reminded of there is that we are truly a globally linked community, that the issues facing Detroit and the issues facing Nairobi are not so different, that humanity is linked by very, very common challenges. And the role that MSU has been playing, working with the community in advancing on both the viability of urban agriculture, all the health benefits that can come from that, plus in time the commercial advantages of that. I mean, remind me that there is neither no stone too small or mountain too large that we can't be engaged with.
The Eli Broad Art Museum has received all kinds of attention lately, and it's a great addition to our campus. I'm a proponent of talking about greatness all around us, and that's what makes our university so good, as we take the best of MSU to the world and the best of the world back to MSU. Our academic programs, our athletic programs, the Wharton Center for the Performing Arts. As we talk about the museum and the great history and tradition, bring it back home for a minute and talk about some of the initiatives that you see, or maybe some of your initial thoughts that you have as Michigan State as a whole versus the city of Detroit.
Well, certainly from the point of view of my role as director at the MSU Museum, I see our unit as a very essential companion to the Broad and the Wharton. Mm-hmm. We're very proud that both of those institutions have world-class facilities, world-class programs. And while we occupy somewhat different bricks and mortar set up from those, we do believe that the programs we're operating in connecting the students of MSU, the communities that MSU serves, with some of the most important and topical issues that relate to society, the natural environment, and also more and more some of the most exciting areas of creativity and research which are happening at MSU. You know, I think our museum in particular, of the three large cultural institutions on campus, has a particular niche in providing meaningful, easily understood connections between what this university is doing and the broadest of audiences. So over the last several years, we have enhanced our program working with partners across campus and partners with the community to actually engage with, well, what does MSU research mean? What are the latest impacts of MSU research in environment, for example, meaning in terms of everyday life? We've got in planning now, for example, and we have to be planning in out years for 2016, a major exhibit that will be looking at climate change in the Great Lakes. Now, we have faculty across campus working in related aspects of climate change. We have major contributions from institutions like University of Michigan and many others. We're not the only players in this. But currently, there is very little, if anything, available that is readily accessible for a wide audience to understand what this all means. It's an incredibly complex story with multiple dimensions. And that, to me, is a key role for a university-based museum to assist in the understanding of some of the most complex issues being advanced by the faculty and graduate students of this campus. And so we more and more we've been orientating our programs to assist that kind of interpretive function.
I think it's fair to say that under your leadership, there's been a renaissance, a resurgence of the MSU Museum as well. Many would think about it as the place where we have a bunch of kids running off of a school bus to go look at something that has been the same for every generation of kids running off the school bus. And there was a period of time when I think the museum sort of got into a bit of a rut in terms of its exhibits. Very, very important work about the Michigan Folklife Festival, so not to diminish it, but the exhibits didn't change all that much from the perspective of the public. Now you've taken that history, the great Michigan connection, folklife, other things, and also added these dimensions of connections to research to bring research, as you say, to a wider audience, but also to really probe some of the key philosophical, ethical, political questions.
Yeah, I think they're vital roles for museums. And recently, for example, we held an exhibit called East Meets West on the transgender community of Istanbul. And it coincided with a very, very large LGBT conference, student conference that was being held here in Lansing. Now, they're topics which are really on the edge and ones which must be spoken about and very topical in the US community now. It's the role of museums to help people engage with those topics, to present issues which can be challenging, but to present them in a way that audiences of all ages can better understand, better appreciate the matters, and thus engage as better informed citizens in the debate.
I think, you know, I'm in athletics, so I have to keep things pretty simple. That's my role. And listening to what you're saying is hitting on what Michigan State's all about and what the values are. And I, as I think of a museum, and I'm trying to put this in simple terms, there's a brick. And the brick is in the museum, and a person looks at it, and it's an on exhibit. And that's what many people think of a museum, as you're looking at the item. And you have taken that item and brought it to life in a way that connects people, which, in my perspective, is the greatest value that Michigan State has. Not just the individual person, but how that person connects with others. And as you take that brick and you think about the engineer, you think about the cause, you think about the purpose, and bring that piece to life, that's what you're doing with the Detroit Project. That's what I see happening with the museum here. And I think as long as you can focus on people and connect those exhibits, it's going to be an unbelievable future for the program and such an asset for the university.
Yeah, I can only agree. I believe absolutely in the importance of collections. Museums do draw very heavily on the wonderful heritage that they hold in their collections. But I say often museums are about ideas. They're not about things. Mm-hmm. If you concentrate on the things, you focus on the brick.
Right.
It's the stories mm-hmm. which make the relevance come alive. Mm-hmm. And it's only through the stories, it's only through the connections. And, of course, the stories are all about people. Mm-hmm. It's only through those stories and connections that people can engage with heritage. So it's an absolutely self-fulfilling connection there. If you focus too much on merely the objects and present them devoid of all of those connections, then you deprive people of the real significance of what museum collections are all about.
Well, I want to sort of close with sort of the promo for Detroit Resurgence. So tell us about when it's going to be, where we can find it, the important elements for the promo so that we can leave people with the sense of coming to Michigan State and then in Detroit.
Got it. So on September 18, we will be launching Detroit Resurgent at the Michigan State University Museum. It'll be a fantastic exhibit. I encourage people, any background, any age, anyone who's got an interest in Detroit or urban renewal to come by. It'll be running at the MSU Museum right through to the end of the year, so they have from September to December. And, of course, when we do move to Detroit in the new year, we'll be promoting and announcing that very widely. We hope we'll get a very different audience and demographic when we're in the city itself.
And then with the first exhibit, we have photographs and short narratives, and then the book will be launched.
Yes, the book launch in April of next year will complement the exhibit. We've got a very, very high quality book that's being produced through Michigan State University Press, fully produced in Michigan. Designed, printed, everything is homegrown here. And yes, that'll be launched in April. And actually, the third phase of this project, and one we haven't spoken of, but I think is also very exciting, after the Detroit run. We want to take this on the road, and we're looking at taking both the exhibit and the book not only around America, but perhaps as importantly overseas. Because as I said in my opening comments, the images of Detroit held by many communities outside of this country are bleak indeed. Mm-hmm. And I think that this product can be a small contribution to changing the world's impression of what is one of the world's great cities.
So our first glimpse is September 18th.
September 18th at the MSU Museum.
Which is the week Spartans are on the road at Notre Dame, and as fans are coming in throughout the year, they'll be able to stop in and see that during the football season and beyond. My last question is, have you ever seen Night at the Museum, the Hollywood picture?
Oh, absolutely. I've seen them both.
Good or bad for museums?
Oh, absolutely. Spectacularly good.
I agree.
Thank you very much, Gary, for being a part of Michigan State and for the great work you're doing through the MSU Museum.
Thank you. Pleasure.
That was MSU Museum Director Gary Morgan talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear their conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com.
Turn it up! Turn it up! A little bit higher! Radio! Turn it up! Burn it up! So you know, radio!
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.